For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, for the record, for the record, for the record, for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's
right. Welcome back to Season 5 of The Clink, Stories of Redemption. How good has Season 5 been so far? We've sat there, we've been put up to number one in the charts, on the iTunes charts. It's been amazing. Thank you, everybody, for your ongoing support. This morning, I have another guest that I have just been super excited to sit down with. This man, his name is Gunnar Tocco Lindblom. He was born into the mob, but that's not what his life's about today. He's a man with an amazing story of redemption from Detroit. Welcome, Gunnar.
Hey, how you doing, man? Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to come and join us on The Clink. Now, for those of us that aren't in the States, they may or may not know who you are. They've only got to Google your name and there's plenty to read. You were quite a notorious man with a very heavy background and upbringing. Your story today is phenomenal to who you are and what you've achieved, and we'll get into that later in the chat. But Gunnar, take us back to the beginning.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of good like mafia stories and mafia tales and things like that. I think mine is very unique, and I guess if you were to kind of ask me to compare it to somebody, I would say Henry Hill, kind of from Goodfellas, if you've seen that movie. The difference is I didn't rat. I didn't went to prison for 13 years and then did my time. And the other difference is that instead of like Henry Hill in the movie Goodfellas, he was connected to just a made guy, Paulie. But the difference is with me is I was more than just connected to a made guy. I was kind of born into the hierarchy of the premier family of the Detroit Mafia, which is the Tocco Zarelli crime family. My grandfather was Peter Paul Tocco. My mother was Grace Tocco. You know, you don't think about it growing up. It was so normal being around mafia figures and mob guys and just the whole mafia thing, where it wasn't even like, it was just completely normal to me. And then I was already a bad kid. My parents got divorced when I was four. And in all reality, my father was lucky to not be killed by my family because he abused my mother. Had she told her brothers or my grandfather that, you know, how he was treating her, he would have been killed, and that would have been that. And that's the reason why she never told. You know what I'm saying? She kept that part from him. And my father says to this day, you know, your mother would have told her brothers, you know, that I beat her up or whatever, they would have killed me, and that would have been the end of it. You know, one of the highest, most, I don't know, revered rules in my family in the mafia was women. You can't disrespect them. You don't look at another man's wife, sister, mother. You don't hit on them. You definitely don't sleep with them. You don't date them. And if you do, that was a capital offense. You'd be killed. I mean, it's not even something they play with. The boss would green light that in a second. So if you a couple times I was tasked with hurting guys, and they were my friends for doing that. One time I was asked to lead a guy to, you know, brought him in an alley at a nightclub, told him we were going to smoke a joint. And then the uncle of a girl that he mistreated was standing out there, broke a bottle, smashed him, cut his throat with the bottle, and, you know, beat the shit out of him. And, you know, the dude sitting there, and he knew I had led him to this fate. Another time, I beat up a guy who was a friend of mine who essentially, he disrespected a made guy's daughter a little bit. And then he started a sports book that, you know, these big factories in Detroit, so certain mob guys, made guys, lay claim to those factories. That's my factory. If anyone's going to sell drugs, it's going to be me. If anyone's going to book, you know, bets there, sports book or numbers or whatever, it's me. So I worked a lot of bookies, you know. I'll tell you some stories about later about that. I mean, that's basically was my full-time job, is collecting for bookies. And I was known to be a real bad guy. In my family, violence wasn't really a big thing. They didn't like to kill or hurt people. Because that brings attention. They try to just use intimidation more than anything to get what they want, and it usually worked. But when they had to, they called a guy like me, and there wasn't many guys like me. There was a small handful of guys who were capable and willing to do violence, which I'm ashamed of. I hate even thinking about it, and I hate even talking about it. But like this guy Nino, who was a friend of mine, I like the kid. It's one of my friends. When the old man came and warned him, I said, "Man, you know, stop booking bets at this freaking factory, man. You get yourself in trouble." And he said, "F you, old man," basically, and really, literally said, "F you," right in front of me to the old man. And I was like, he wasn't old, but he was like 45 years old, younger than I am now. And then I got called in by my Uncle Pete, who's my mother's brother, my boss, my liaison to that world, essentially. And he said, you know, the old man, I don't want to say his name, says he wants Nino hurt bad in the hospital, minimum. And he wants you to do it, and he wants to see you do it. So I'm like, "You're kidding me? He wants me to see me do it?" He says, "Yeah, I'll give you $3,000. He's going to give you $3,000 to do it. So you know, it won't be for nothing." So I brought the kid to a pool hall, you know, and just the guy was waiting in the kitchen, and I went in there. I said, "He's out there. You want to see this? You sure you want to see this?" He says, "Yeah." And then so we come walking back out, and he's behind me, and right when we got to the table, like Nino looks up and his eyes get all big, and he sees, like, "What the F is this?" You know, because I got this old man with him. And then I just started pounding him. But the thing was, the first punch, I smashed him in the face, like right in the mouth, nose area, so there'd be some blood. And after that, I kind of wailed on him for 30, 40 seconds, you know, saying, "Man, I told you, I told you, I tried to tell you," bang, 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 bang. He just kind of covers up, protects his face. And then, you know, I stomp him out pretty good. A couple of days later, I call him, you know, I'm like, "Man, how you feeling? How you feeling, man?" He's like, "Man, not too good. My head's sore." You know, he's like, "How you feeling?" I'm like, I feel bad, you know what I mean? But I warned you, bro. I tried to tell you, man. And he's like, "You know, really, you had to do that for the guy?" I said, "Yes, I had to do it because I was told to do it." Second, I said, "You're lucky I did it, because if it was somebody else doing it,
it probably
would hurt you a lot worse." Yeah. Yeah, I was able to control the beating. I was able to make it look good and still beat your ass. But had it been the next guy, they might have put you in the hospital for a month or killed you. So be thankful I did it. We were never friends after that again. He didn't want to be around me. He never came around. You know, we used to hang out in the market. It was Eastern Market in Detroit, which is basically Detroit's little Italy. It's like a square, like, quarter mile of all these food and produce businesses, wholesalers that basically control the entire city of Detroit. If you have any municipal contracts, like my grandpa had the schools. So my grandpa Toco had all the schools, Wayne County schools, for 40 years. He controlled all the huge, huge multi-million dollar contract that would get to him every year. And then he'd kick back, you know, a couple $100,000 to the boss, because the boss would go, the guy who gave out the contracts, let me give you a little tutorial on how the mob works and how a lot of mafia families work like this, or at least used to. New York is kind of a mess these days, but Detroit is still very well-oiled in this regard.
So still, even to today, Detroit is still holding strong.
Yeah, the boss got hit with a RICO in 2007 and beat it. We were just talking about that on my podcast and on my show, YouTube show, Gunner Detroit.
Yep.
But so basically, if they want to get somebody, what they do, this is what they do across the board, from the mayor to the city comptroller, the city councilman, all the people in charge of the big municipal contracts. They say, "We're going to put you in there. All right. We're going to get you elected. And then when you get there, we want those contracts for road construction, bridge repair, you know, new schools and food distribution, sanitation, you know, garbage removal, all that." And they're like, "Yeah, sure, you can get me in. I'll take care of you." So what they do is the mob guys go to all their union guys, heads of the Teamsters, heads of the UAW, United Auto Workers Unions, with got 400,000 employees or whatever it is. And they just, you know, this is the guy to vote for. When the election comes, vote for this guy. He's our guy. He's going to be good for us. He's going to be good for the family. He's going to be good for business. He's going to be good for everybody. Vote for this guy. So they vote him in. And now the city allocates the $25 million contract or budget to fix, you know, 4 miles of old roads on Gratian Avenue. And who do you think gets the contract? They inflate the bid up, you know, 10-15%. They give the guy who gives it to him a kickback, Swiss account, money in the Swiss account, whatever. So they get $1-2 million. The contractor, you know, is all owned by ghosts. You know, the mafia isn't necessarily the face of these companies, because that would be, you know, tie them too closely together. So they have a front man who owns or runs them, and then they get all the money. The money flows uphill. One of the things about the Detroit Mafia is they really hobnob a lot with the elite of the elite of society. All the elite of the society, to them, they are want to be seen with them. They want to kind of work with them quietly. So they'll own a business front, get the money coming in. The money all flows uphill to the boss, and it's stupid money. It's not like in New York, for example. Well, I'm sure it was at one time like this, but you know, you got these guys who hang out in a social club, you know, and they got 10 guys under them, and those guys are on the streets, you know, got a little bookie, look like a little sports book, book numbers, maybe a little drugs, a little something. And every week that guy kicks up an envelope of $500 or something to their skipper, their maid guy. Or whatever, and that keeps them happy, you know. So if you got 10 guys picking up $500 a week or $200 a week, they make $3,000-$5,000 a week. In Detroit, it doesn't work like this. The guys that have been pruned and groomed for decades, and they've been put into position to get these giant contracts. So now when it's time to kick up, like my grandpa, he didn't kick up $500; he kicked up $200,000, and so that's how that. So you might only have. Every crew might only have 4 or 5 made guys, but they're kicking up, you know, a couple hundred thousand a year, not a couple hundred a week. And so, and it's all because of stuff like that. And there's drugs and there's loan sharking. There's a lot of gambling. It's a huge gambling racket, And I'll get into that later on. But the money that's pouring in is astronomical. I mean, it's just, no matter what I say, you just can't wrap your mind around it. I mean, just tens of millions of dollars. So it's not like these low-level guys. These guys are clocking them. I mean, they're the boss, Jack Tocco, who's my uncle through a, well, it was my grandfather's father's first cousin, but they were raised like brothers. In fact, they thought they were brothers until they were like 20, because my grandmother sent my great-grandfather to America to escape a mafia vendetta in Sicily that were just like the Godfather, and they were going to kill him. So they sent him here, and he hid under an alias name, and he lived with his cousin or my great aunt or whatever. And so that's how they were raised. So he was murdered right after Prohibition. And that's a crazy story in itself. He slept with a woman. He slept with the wrong woman, and his own brother had to sign off on his murder. And so they did. And my grandfather never really got over that, even though.
But these are the rules, aren't they? Like brother, you were just saying before, you don't mess with another man's woman, full stop.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the brother who survived was William Vito or Black Bill Tocco, became like the godfather of Detroit, him and his cousin Uno Zarelli. Well, anyways, my great grandfather who was murdered, son is my grandpa, who was born, born in Sicily. And then came back here, and he landed here. He met my grandmother on the boat coming over, which is crazy. She was only like 14 years old, and he was like 16, and he ended up falling in love with her on the boat. And he said, "I'm going to St. Louis. I'm going to join the military so I can get citizenship. When I get done, I'm going to come find you, and I'm going to marry you." She's like laughing, like, "Yeah, sure, pal." You know, I've heard the story a bunch of times, my grand.
Yeah.
So. She's like, "Yeah, okay, sure, buddy." And sure enough, man, he went to the military for 4 years. He claimed he saved up his entire year's wage in the military to buy the ring, which is a 5-carat blue Alaskan flawless diamond that today would be worth about $250,000. So he said that he you know, saved up, but I'm sure he made some money illicitly ahead of that or when he did, and then bought this gigantic ring. And then he came to Detroit and just found her father. And said, "I'd like to take your daughter's hand in marriage if you'll, you know."
So he had never met her father before. He'd never met the father at all.
On the boat. No, he had met her on the boat.
Okay. But that was it.
But very, very briefly, you know, they had like a 10-day ride on the boat from Italy. And this is like after World War II. And they were worried about becoming like a communist fascist society where the Sicilian peasants would become like slaves to the upper echelons of society. So anybody with even a couple bucks ran, got the frick out of there, and ended up in America. Some went to South America when they started turning them away. But anyway, so he accepted the my great grandfather said yes. I mean, and they married and were married for 64 years. They had 5 kids, and one was my mother. So that ring is still in my family. My aunt owns it. I'm kind of upset about that. It should have went to me. I won't get into how they screwed me over. My aunt screwed me out of. I was in prison. When they died, my grandparents died, and they dicked me out of my portion of the inheritance. me and my sister were supposed to get 1/5 of the estate, which is probably, I'd guess, around $500,000 or $600,000 or more. They own a bunch of apartment complexes. They had a ton of freaking money. And my aunts, when my grandmother was like, you know, 90 years old and kind of demented, they got her to sign off that on the will, that, you know, Alonzo's in prison. You know, he's a freaking loser. You know, we had to sign it. And anyway, so the guy, as soon as my aunt got all that money, by the way, she divorced her scumbag husband. And then now she's got some money. But the thing is, it's funny. If anyone reads my books, To Be a King, the main, one of the main nemesis characters' name is Leone, which is based on my uncle, her husband. I never had anything against him, you know, really. But he was kind of inspired the character in that book. His name is Leone.
In Australia, there's a lot of, I guess, people run off a lot of movies and what we read. This is firsthand. Now, you've lived and breathed this life. You've been around it. I want to ask you something. We see a lot of, and quote me if I'm wrong, a lot of mob families with Irish-Italian connection. I know that you state in your book and other podcasts and stuff about not being able to be a made man because you weren't 100% Italian or
Yeah,
Sicilian.
That is correct. So there's no real Irish connection in Detroit. There's Irish, so a few Irish, half Irish wise guys that kind of like are associates, but not really.
Yeah.
So in that world, you have to be at least 50% Sicilian on your father's side.
On your father? Okay. So the bloodline.
I was 50% Sicilian on my mother's side. So I'm what's called a dragoni or a defetto. Defetto means defective. That's what they call them. Nobody ever called me that to my face, but I know that they would call half-breeds like me dragonis, which means half-breed. It's a very derogatory term. Nobody would ever say that to me. And later in life, I confronted my cousins. And I'm like, man, you guys freaking see me as a dragoni? And they'd be like, I mean, these guys are terrified of me, too. Terrified. And they'd be like, nah, hell, never, bro, never. You saw you as a toco, bro. You're one of us. You're like, you know, you're with us, bro. We never thought for a second. But I know they kind of looked down their nose.
In the back of your mind, how did you feel knowing that you possibly could never, even if that was, you know, your choice of life and lifestyle, and that's the direction you obviously were heading back then, but you always knew in the back of your mind you were never going to be that made guy because of that reason. That's got to have sort of had a little bit of, well, let's just say a bit of animosity in you.
Well, you know, you nailed it there, and I could do a whole show about that, but what I will tell you is this. I came up very young into that world around 12, 13 years old. Let me just, I'll tell you the whole story so it kind of has context. So, you know, growing up, my uncle, Pete, who was only 12 years older than me, was a bad guy, street guy, wise guy, gangster. He loved me. I was his favorite little nephew. I was his oldest nephew. And so I was with him all the time. And I remember when I was a little kid, somebody said, they can't play with me anymore because I'm in the mafia. I didn't even know what the mafia was. And again, it happened. Another girl didn't invite me to a party. And this is in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. It's big money. Like, I'm not exaggerating or just saying this. Grosse Pointe, Michigan is the most expensive real estate per inch in America.
Wow.
And so it's big baller central. And where I live with all the hierarchy of the mafia, that's what I'm saying. That's the difference between, again, families like New York and stuff, where a bunch of wise guys kind of live in a, you know, middle class area of like Brooklyn or something. These guys, the higher ups, most of them all live within a 4 or 5 block radius in multi-million dollar mansions. The cops were paid off. Everybody's paid off. So they didn't have to worry too much.
So a hub, just a hub of basically protection and green lights.
Yeah. Yeah. They called it the compound is what I think it was referred to. So all these mob bosses lived in the same couple blocks. And I grew up in that. Right. So one girl said, you know, I said, why didn't you invite me to the party? I was real sad. I had a crush on her. Her name was Jackie Reed. And she said, my mom says you're in the mafia. I'm like, what the F is the mafia? So I asked my uncle. He says, don't worry about Alonzo. It's just our family. It's our family. Don't think. So years, you know, now I'm really paying attention as a child how people treat us differently than everybody else. When we go down to the market, everybody would say, you know, see my grandpa and my uncle and like, hey, how you doing, Pete? Come on, start by son. And give him a hug and shake his hand with two hands. Hey, good. I need some meat, we're having you or whatever. And they go, oh, here, let me hook you up. And they big a package and say, oh, take it. Just take it. No, your money's no good here. Nobody. But they didn't do that to anyone else. So I kind of noticed, you know, the way they treated my uncle and my grandpa and whatever. And then all these wise guys would come through the house all the time because my grandpa was a big layoff bully. So his crew was basically his brother Joe and Tony Corrado. These guys were all like big shot layoff bookies. They didn't even bet little bets. They took the bets that the that the main bookies, 40-50 bookies, couldn't handle.
Wouldn't take.
They balance their book, and they push it over on these old men. And then they'd balance it with Vegas, and then they'd have four or five phones going in all the time. And so they'd come over all the time. My Uncle Nicky, my Uncle Joe, my Uncle Tony, Jack Tocco, the boss. They'd all come around and hang around. And so I was around them so much that I just kind of put two and two together until my uncle began to explain to me who's who. He didn't explain to me who's who till I was around 15, 16 years old. And that's after I was expelled from school. By the time I was 15, I had already been out of the youth home two or three times. I got expelled from school indefinitely. The district refused to even let me back in. I was out. So now I'm full-time in the streets. I'm selling drugs, selling weed, a little bit of cocaine.
Were they not worried, though, that you were from a family? Were they not worried that you were from a mafia family and that there could be repercussions for you being told you can't come back to school?
They weren't worried.
Not at all.
They weren't worried.
Okay.
I thought they would be. Believe me when I tell you. The first time I ever saw my grandfather, who was a very reticent, calm, even-keeled man, very respected, highly revered. Everybody feared him. He was an OG, triple OG. The guy walks in everywhere, and, you know, Mr. Tocco, how you doing? We had a meeting after I was expelled from school, got caught in this stolen property ring, which is just, it was just my punk-ass friend, Ricky, stealing. I bought a coat. Then somebody saw me wearing it because he told me it was his brother's. But I wouldn't rat my boy out. So because I wouldn't rat my boy out, I took the fall for it, and I got expelled. So my grandpa and my mother arranged a meeting with the head of the superintendent of the school board and all this. So there was literally the school cop, the superintendent, principal, vice principal. I don't know. There was like five or six people there. And he walked in, and he looked around at him real calmly, very intimidating, says, "Do you know who I am?" And they said, "Yeah, Mr. Tocco, we know who you are." He's like, "Well, I want my grandson to stay in school and graduate. I want him to go to college." Mm. And they're like, "Mr. Tocco, we don't want him here. He's not wanted. He's in trouble. He's always fighting. He's involved with bad kids. He comes to school smelling like pot. He's this, that, that. We don't want him." And he's like, "Well, I want him here." And they're like, "We don't care. He's not welcome in this school. Wow. Anywhere in this district. He can go to adult ed." So that was that. So I just got kicked out of school. Sad as hell, man. They didn't care because they're civilians. You know, you're not going to go killing civilians or, you know, extorting civilians, you know, like that. It don't work like that. It's not how the game works.
No, I understand that one.
They basically kicked me out, and definitely. So now I'm full-time in the streets. Then my Uncle Pete catches me with some weed. And drugs were a real bad thing in my house. Like, it was like the worst thing imaginable, drugs. Because my uncle got busted selling coke, and he got out of it. But my grandparents was on his ass for forever about it.
So
and,
was it a big thing, so too, there, Gunnar, where... Was it a big thing there where, you know, like you said, the drugs were shone down upon if you were in the family and you were caught using drugs? I understand there was a lot of money made through different drug transactions through whoever and whatever, but for you to be able to be a part of a family like that, say, for example, you know, your grandfather found you with a bag of coke or, you know, bag of weed or whatever, and, you know, would that be shone upon that you're not good?
I would have been in big trouble. Yeah. I would have been in big trouble if my grandfather found a bag of coke. Yeah. Big trouble. And so, well, I'll tell you a couple quick stories. So what happened was my uncle, who got busted with coke, my Uncle Pete, he lived with his grandparents still because he was still in his 20s. He lived with his parents. They were my grandparents. I went over there. I'd go over there every weekend for dinner and hang out on Sunday, Saturday, Sunday. And he bought me this jacket, which is just like his. It was this like leather biker jacket, this black leather biker jacket. Cause he was like a half-ass biker. He hung around a lot of bikers. And, but you know, sometimes he dressed like that. Most of the time he dressed like a wise guy, but we had the same jackets and he bought it for me. It was a nice jacket, like $300-$400 jacket. Originally he got me when I was brown. I didn't like it. I'm like, I want the black one like you. So he gets it. So I come over, I got a freaking bag of weed in the pocket and like a roll of money. And I was about 16 years old, and he grabs his jacket to go run to the store or the market or whatever, and he sees in the pocket, he reaches in the pocket, he feels something, and he pulls it out. So then he calls me downstairs. He's like, "Alonzo, basement, like that, basement." And I knew if he's going to the basement, something's up. So he comes in the basement, and he freaking takes a bag of weed. I'm like, now I get the chills. I'm like, oh, shit, I'm in trouble, man. And immediately I thought, man, I hope he didn't tell Grandpa. I'm like, what's a bag of weed? What do you do? You need to tell Grandpa? I put it out. He sells it and goes, he dumps it. No, he starts to dump it. He throws it at me. He goes, "This is some bullshit weed. If you're going to sell weed, sell good weed." He goes, "Come here." I'm like, "All right." So I follow him upstairs, go out in the garage. He's got some banana boxes. Like, my grandpa owned a produce business, so there was always like big bunch of banana boxes for storage. And he opened one of these banana boxes, and there's like 10 pounds of like good weed in there. And he's like, you know, take one of these. And I'm like, what are you paying? And I think I was paying $1,000 a pound. He's like, all right, I'll take that for $1,000. You know, when you pay me more, get, you know, when you need more, let me know. At least you'll have good freaking weed. So I was like, all right. So now I'm off and running on the weed selling tip. And I did really good. I won't say I was like booming, banging, but I was making a lot of money, man. You know, breaking down bags and selling bags and quarter pounds. And I was making a ton of money, but I had so much trash in my house that I stopped doing that. I started fronting the weed out to guys. I had a crew of four or five guys that were selling them. I got them all beepers and stuff. And I'm just like, you know, if I get a call for weed, I'm going to send some in your way. I still delivered my own bags because that's where the most profit was. But really, I was making probably, you know, $2,000-$3,000 a week on the weed, which is a lot of money back in, you know, 1989. A bunch of my boys played football, and they were like all athletic and worked out. And I noticed all the girls like were into them because they're all muscle bound and stuff. So I wanted to start working out, get like them, man. And I wanted to be like them. And so we started training, and then I got involved in selling steroids. I didn't take steroids. Everybody thought I did because I got big really fast. I have pretty good genetics, and I work harder than everybody.
I've seen pictures of you.
I work really hard to work out.
I've seen pictures of you. You're a machine. Yeah, you're a machine.
Yeah. Thank you. And I'm almost 50 years old. So, but at the time I was blowing up, you know, I had natural steroids, testosterone, because I was in puberty and stuff. And so I just kind of blew up and everybody, but I was selling steroids. So I assumed I was on them. They're like, I want what you're on, bro. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not on nothing. You just got to work hard and eat good and you'll blow up too. But I sold steroids and then I got busted selling steroids. A pretty large quantity. I got set up by a scumbag. I didn't know the game. I didn't know the drug game the way I would learn it later, but I was stupid and had some guy introduce me to a guy. It's his friend, and it turns out to be a Fed. And so I do a hand-to-hand sale of like 5 G's worth of steroids to this guy twice. They don't bust me right away because it turned out that they had followed me to my dealer's house, and they realized that my dealer, this guy named Joe D., a huge bodybuilder dude who's the wise guy, a mob guy, he was basically about to get indicted. The feds were on him, like wired, you know, phone wired, house surveillance. They've been on him for months. They're about to freaking hammer him. I don't know none of this. I'm just a young kid. I always go over there like looking slick like a wise guy too. I didn't wear a dress like this, and I wear like a shirt and tie or a suit when I go over there.
They would have had you on surveillance anyway. Coming back and forth and getting the roids from him, for sure.
Oh, yeah. I was all under surveillance. I saw the pictures. The FBI came to my house and showed them to me. So they showed me pictures of me coming and going, carrying a bag. I'd walk out with a freaking bag. So anyways, I didn't know none of that, neither did he. And then they busted him, I don't know, you know, a couple months after I did the hand-to-hand sale. They bust him. I come to the gym, and like everybody in the gym knew I was like a young wise guy hustler. The whole gym, everybody, like I was the youngest guy in Joe DiMaggio's crew who was working with him. They were all older, like 30, 35 year old guys. I'm like 17. And so I pull up and I got a tricked out Mustang bumping. And I was just jewelry and I played the part. So when I walked in one day, it was real quiet and everybody was looking at me, and I'm kind of like, what the frick's going on in here in this gym? This is, by the way, the paper said, the FBI said this is the most steroid infested gym in America, a little gym called Muscle Gym in St. Clair Stores, Michigan. So when I walked in, it was quiet. And I walked up to the counter. I had a pull out stereo. I don't know if you remember those, a pull out Alpine. We pull it out. Of
yeah.
Your
yeah. The car. That's right. It's in the cradle. And yeah, just, yeah, yeah. People used to rip them off exactly. All the time.
Little kids.
Yeah.
And the chick says, you hear about Joe? And I'm like, what about Joe? She's like, he got raided last night, midnight. And I'm like, my heart dropped, my son. So I know that I might be involved in this. Like about 2 days later, they come to my house and arrest me, take me to jail. I bond out. And then, you know, because I'm going to fight the case. But the newspaper did a story that said, steroid bust linked to organized crime. And there's like a picture of me. And they're saying, it made it sound like I ratted or something. Steroid bust, organized crime.
Right.
So now it made it look. So now I call Joe because I'm tripping. He's out on bond too, $1 million bond. He was a baller. So he got busted with what they said was 25 million doses of steroids, a bunch of coke, 10 pounds of weed, 100 weapons, firearms, 10,000 rounds of ammunition.
Right.
The guy got busted with all this stuff. So he So he pulls the bond, $1 million bond, gets a big shot lawyer. But I call him 2 days later, and I'm like, after they get me, and I said, Joe, man, I got to talk to you, man. He's like, yeah, come over. So I come over to the house. He does this. He said, come on, let's walk. So we go. He had these Rottweilers. He raised Rottweilers. And we grab his Rottweilers, and we go down the block, and we're walking the dogs. He said, I said, Joe, I just want you to know, man, I didn't say nothing to anybody about nothing. And he says, stop. He's like, I know you didn't say nothing, bro. And I said, but the newspapers made it sound like, he's like, I know everything. You didn't say nothing. I already know. So that was good. He believed me. And then he's like, the game is over. He's like, I do have some stuff around still. If you want it, I can get it to you. And so that was that. And I fought that case for like 18 months.
You end up getting charged as well. So you had to go through all the whole process.
Yeah. So what happened is the FBI came to my house and were questioning me. And it's funny, there was two Al's. He had this book, man. Joe had this ledger. So whenever you got something, he'd write it down. 10 bottles of this, 10 bottles of that. And it was all in there, man. It was just this ledger. And so they got the ledger. And it's one of the things he said when it was out. Like, they got the ledger, so they're going to be calling you. Because he had my number there, and the guy was keeping the best records of it. So the FBI comes. It's this big, tall freaking guy. And he's like, you know, there's two Al's. Which are you? I'm like, man, I was just getting some stuff for my boys from playing football. That's it. He's like, well, one guy's only a few thousand. The other guy's moving like 50,000. I'm like, yeah, that's not me. But it was me. You know what I'm saying? Like, the big money was me. But I said, it wasn't me. That's the guy. I'm little nobody, man. So
Just a kid.
Yeah, that's all I was. So anyways, when I got arrested on that case, my Uncle Salvatore Tocco, my mother's other brother, picks me up from the jail to bond me out. He bonds me out. And we get in the car, and he won't even look at me. We're driving, and I keep looking at him. I said, does Grandpa know? He said, he's going to see the judge tomorrow. And I said, is he mad? He looked at me. He's like, what, are you stupid? I'm like, what do you think? He already told you about drugs.
Ooh.
You know? And I'm like, what the fuck, man, it was steroids. It was always steroids. So he went, my grandpa went and bribed the judge, paid him $10,000, handed him a $10,000 envelope of money, says, I don't want him to go to prison. He said, all right. So they ended up giving me, I fought it in court on and on, like, till I got it lower down to, we were going back and forth. Eventually it went down to conspiracy to possess analog steroids. And I got 6 months work release in the county jail, but I ended up getting kicked out of the work release. I got kicked out of it because I jury rigged my schedule so I could go get laid. And then that was warning one. And then the second one was some black dude snatched a cookie off my plate, off my tray. Cause I'm, you know, it's in the jail. Unless you're working, you're in jail. And it's like unit. And some black dude like sits down across from me. He's kind of new. He's like, let me get that cookie, dog. I'm like, I'm eating my cookie, man. He said, man, look at the cookie. I said, nah, man, I'm eating my cookie, man. Like, beat it. He reached over across the table, grabs my cookie. So I just jump over the table, wham, and freaking jaw jack him, knock him on the ground, start whooping his ass. And they saw it. They all saw it. So I ended up getting kicked out of work release, and they sent me to the tower, which is the main jail. And I ended up getting a time cut, a freakish time cut. My girl paid a lawyer to get me in front of the judge to try and get, you know, some time shaved off. And they shaved off 34 days. So I only ended up doing like 3 months in jail.
America has a different sort of setup when it comes to the jail system. So when you talk about working or work release jail, here, that comes way, way down the track of your sentence. Like for me, doing 6 years, there was no work release. I just didn't get to that stage. It was just, I got released on parole, 3 years parole. But that was from a medium to maximum in the end, from maximum. With you guys over there, are you in jail and still... So you can be sentenced to a minimum security jail and be working as part of your rehabilitation. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it's only for small time things, county jail time. So it's a year less. If you have a year or less, if you're sentenced to a year left, you can maybe get work release.
Right.
But most people don't. Same. But sometimes it's it. If you get more than a year, you go to prison. But
yep. Okay.
So I was, you know, I had 6 months and you get 1 month good time. So I actually kept my good time, even though I got kicked out of work release. And then I got a 34-day time reduction. But at the end, I just did like, you know, 97 days or whatever it was. And then I got out. And I mean, the day that I got out, like, no, everybody thought I was still in jail. Even my girlfriend, she wouldn't know if she had to go to school. She had exams that day. And I come walking into the school And I just got out of jail. Like, I had my Ninja, my motorcycle, parked in my grandparents' garage. They picked me up, my grandparents, and then we brought me home. And I was pasty and pale, you know. I've been in jail for 3 months. Jumped on my Ninja. The battery was dead. I didn't care. I had no plates on it, like expired plates. I push started it. Gotta go. And got freaking, and then went ripping. You know, the first thing I did is went look for my girlfriend.
Yeah.
So I went to my girlfriend and grabbed her up. And then after that, I went right back into the game, man. Quick. I mean, I didn't even wait, man. I mean, I probably got a pound of weed fronted to me within 3 days. You know what I mean? And I steroids too. I was right back in the steroid game, selling pills. I was just right everything. I was living with my grandparents, which was a gravy. You know, my grandmother freaking takes care of me, cooks for me, does my laundry, feeds me, does everything. And my grandpa, so this is where it gets more interesting for you guys. This is around the time when this happens, when I was 19 years old or 20. I think I turned 20 in jail, come to think of it. And my grandpa his eyes were starting to go bad, and he had gotten a couple minor car accidents, and he scared the shit out of me a couple times driving, and almost like blew red lights and crap. And I said, "Grandpa, from now on, when you got to go see your Gumbadis," which is his boys, I said, "let me drive." He said, "okay." And here's the thing. Keep in mind, for the last six, seven years, I've been kicked out of school, freaking expelled for fighting. I've been in a youth home for fighting. I got felonious assaults, stolen property, false police reports. I got all this destruction of property over 1,000, on and on and on. And I'm just a kid. And then, so all these high-level mob guys, my uncles, including one of them named Tony Giacalone, who's a very famous mafioso, his daughter married my cousin. And that's how our families kind of became close. And he became close with my grandpa because he was a big layoff bookie. And Tony had a bunch of bookies, a bunch of bookies, like let's say 50 of them.
Wow.
And when they needed layoff, they lay off my grandpa. So my grandpa was, there was like 100 bookies, just these two crews. Just two of like the 10 crews, you know. The 10 crews are all part of a bigger crew, but there's kind of their own little compartmentalized things. But anyway, so I would drive around with my grandpa to go see these guys and pick up money, drop money off. That's it. But that wasn't like a work thing. It was almost like a social thing. You drop by Tony's place. You're like, "Hey, Tony, how you doing?" You sit down in his office for a little while, chat, kick, you know, maybe play a little penny poker with the guys. You go down to the market and you see some of these guys, and they all had their little, you know, their little areas in the warehouses where they'd have pool tables and freaking, you know, card tables, and they'd all be hanging out, just like in the movies. Bunch of freaking wise guys sitting around busting balls, smoking cigars, playing penny poker. And I would go see them. Now, when I go see them, they knew who I was because, you know, I was kind of notorious already for being a freaking an idiot, you know, always fighting and acting a fool, getting kicked out of school. I mean, tearing up nightclubs. I started tearing up nightclubs when I was like 16, 17 years old, you know, and I throw the name. I go in there and say, "I'm Pete Tocco's nephew, man." You know, and they let me right in. Didn't matter that I was 16 years old. And I'm like, these 10 guys behind me, they're with me. So that they couldn't say no. They're like, "Well, you're not going to turn Pete Tocco's nephew away, even though he's got 10 of these punks with him, and they're going to come in here and start fighting. They're all going to get in here drunk and wild out and start fighting. And what do you happen? We'll beat some asses in there." They throw the other guys out. They'd leave us stay because they didn't want to beef with us, you know?
Yeah.
So, because we were that crazy, you know, this little cruel, crazy kid. Some of them were my cousins, some were this tough guy friends of mine. So these guys, these older wise guys, they knew who I was because I grew up with them. You know what I'm saying?
Of course.
Were my uncles and they were at my house. They grew up, but now they're hearing these freaking stories of badness. So now when I go to their clubs, keep in mind when they're at my house and my mother and my grandmother and my aunts and stuff are all there, they don't act like gangsters. They don't act.
No. You know,
they don't want to talk about gangster stuff. They don't want to talk about, there's normal uncles. But when I go see them at their headquarters and they're sitting around smoking cigars, they'd be like, "Alonzo, man, what happened at Nicky's the other day?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "I heard you freaking teared up Nicky's place then." Okay, man, listen. So I started telling him the story, and I'm like, "Listen, this freaking guy, man, And before you know what, I'm over. I'm like, man, I got this freaking guy. I'm smashing his freaking head. And then I grab a chair, smash, bang. And my boy jumps in, and his boy jump in, crash, boom, boom. Before you know, we're slamming chairs off. And they're laughing. These guys are, like, smiling. And I was a natural storyteller, and they loved to hear the stories. And the reason why, they would always say, oh, that reminds me of the time me and Tommy or me and whoever, we did this when we were a kid, this one thing happened, and this guy disrespected him. And next thing you know, I freaking hit him with this and blah, blah, blah. And they're telling me their stories. So they're animated. Me to jumping around yelling, yeah, and they're old men now. These guys are 50, 60, 70 years old, you know. Yeah. So they liked me, and they kind of could relate to me. I remember looking at my grandpa. He'd sit there kind of smiling, but half of them was kind of ashamed, and half of them was kind of proud of me. Like, half of them, I think he was more ashamed than proud, because he's like, this is my freaking grandson's a knucklehead, man. He's an absolute idiot. But these guys who are my goombaddies, my friends all my life, they like him, and they really respect him because he's like them. So he was a bad, you know. So my grandfather tried to push me to be in college after that. He never tried. You know, I did go to community college for like a couple semesters while I was living at their house, and that made him very happy and proud. But, you know, then I got more trouble, and then I left their house because I had so many girls calling, and it was driving my grandmother crazy. So I went and lived with my boy Nick Morelli, and then I eventually got a house in Mount Clemens and then Detroit. So I just, everywhere I went, I just left a trail of
destruction,
like, devastation, you know, destruction, and a lot of, like, and, you know, sold drugs and had, I started having after hours parties and this, these big, like, big keg bashes. And I mean, everything I did was illegal. Everything. I worked, I bounced, I was a bouncer. So I worked at all these nightclubs. That's another thing. So the wise guys, by the way, I didn't tell you. So while I'm getting to know these guys, they start saying, Alonzo, you want to make a buck? You know, I need a buck. This guy's been freaking, you know, spinning me for weeks. He owes me for anything. I want you to go pay him a visit. You know, tune him up a little bit, man. Let him know we're not happy. I said, all right, you know what? He's like, don't worry, I'll take care of you. So I go to the guy. Maybe I punch him in the mouth and say, man, you owe, man. You got to pay, whatever. And then I get the money, and I bring it back, and they cut me off a piece. So now Tony Jack, I do this for Tony Jack one time. This is a crazy story I've told on my YouTube channel a couple of times, but he calls me one day. I was only like 19 years old. I was living with my grandparents. And he says, this, my girlfriend, he didn't say girlfriend. He's like, this girl, her ex-husband came home. Now that's why I don't want to say it was his girlfriend, because I still got cousins and family that watch this hear this.
Yeah.
And it's probably not a surprise that he had a girlfriend on the side. But I can't say for sure it was his girlfriend. He just said, it's like 7 in the morning. He calls me. He says, this girl's ex-husband shows up and beat her up, smacked her around. He's like, I want you to, can you handle it? I said, yeah, Tony, no problem. You know, whatever you need. He said, gives me the address. I call my workout partner, Dario. He says, I said, listen, man, we got to go right now. Get ready. I said, come get me. I mean, right now, walk out the door. He's like, do I need my piece, like gun, you know? And I said, no, bring that. Bring a freaking a baseball bat or something. So he ends up showing up with a pool stick. And I was like, all right. So we go to the house. The guy's passed out drunk in the back, you know, back bedroom. And long story short is I beat the shit out of the guy real bad. I wasn't even going to beat him that bad, but he tried to fight back. He thought he was a tough guy. He's one of those guys. He thought he was a tough guy. Most tough guys aren't tough guys. I mean, 99% of the guys in the world running around acting like they're tough guys. They're really not tough guys. They're not tough guys when they meet a real tough guy. And I'm telling you, I grabbed this guy by his hair, and I said, you like to beat up women, huh? And he freaked, who the F is you? And he, like, tried to swing it on me. I had a big gold nugget ring, huge nugget ring, and I just freaking pulverized his face. I just grabbed, wham, 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 wham.
There's that animation again. There's that animation.
Yeah, I gotta let him have it. You know, Dario cracks him with the pool stick in the ribs, probably broke his ribs. And I just grab him by the hair and I drag him out down these steps because he lived on the top floor of like a duplex. And that whole time he's screaming, and who are you? Blah, blah, blah. And he had dragging blood trail. It was really bloody. I did tell her to put the kids in the bedroom before I did it, though, because I knocked on the door real lightly and she came to the door. All I said was, where is he? And she's like, in the bedroom, whispered, you know, in the bedroom. I said, get the kids in the bedroom. Get them. They don't want to see it. You don't want to see this. And she brushed them up. Gotta go ahead. Go in the bedroom, kids. And then I freaking just mollywopped this dude. So,
what the? It's a mollywop, brother. lay that shit down for me. You kicked his ass or you mollywopped it? Which one?
I mollywopped that mother that's a Detroit thing, man.
I like it.
It's a Detroit term, I guess.
What have you been doing, man? Just mollywopping? Bam, mollywopping bugs' asses.
I mollywopped that mother effer. You got to follow it up with mother effer.
I'll
that
say it for
effer.
You. Mollywop that motherfucker. I said it for you.
Right? Mollywop, say it. Yes. I don't curse. But no, that's all right. I'm telling a story and I got to, like something I said. But the funny thing about that dude was, after I freaking mollywop him and drag him outside, he had this brown van. I said, now get the fuck out of here before I freaking, you know, get the F out of here. And he's going, look what you did. Well, so he gets in his car and looks in the mirror. He's blood everywhere. And he goes, look what you did to my face. And I said, yeah, mother effer. I said, you put your hands on a woman again. I said, you're going to need a surgeon to put your face back together. You got that? So he starts reaching under the seat all of a sudden. The door's open. I'm holding this door open. He's kind of acting like slow. He starts reaching. I grab his arm. I'm like, what you doing, mother? And I pull it out. He's got a crowbar. I grabbed the crowbar from him. I said, get the fuck out of here. I said, split your head open with this mother. And he said, get out of here. And he did. So the girl told Tony what I did. She just said, I don't know, that guy that you sent over here, you know, he was for no games. That he came straight in there and just
got the business done
on my ex. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even like, you know, there was no, the guy didn't have a chance. And she told him, she's like, this is a guy, so his whole life is pretending to be a tough guy. He's telling, you know, how many people he beat up. And he's just that, this freaking guy you sent over. It was like, this is what she said. He treated him like a little kid. Grabbed him by the hair and beat him up like he was a child. And I wasn't even that big. I just knew how to handle myself. You know, I was like 190 pounds and ripped up. You know what I mean? So I was real muscular and worked out and very athletic, but I wasn't no giant dude like slinging around grown men, but I did. He tried to fight back, and that's when I let him have it. I wasn't going to hurt him until he like tried swinging on me and fighting back. I was just going to freaking slap him around. But anyways, after that, Tony now – So let me just preface this and set the stage with regard to Tony Giacalone. Tony Giacalone is the guy that Jimmy Hoffa was meeting the day Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. So if you know the Jimmy Hoffa story, this is the guy that Jimmy Hoffa was going to meet the day Jimmy Hoffa vanished. Tony Giacalone, for all intents and purposes, practical intents, was the most powerful mob guy in Detroit. I won't say ever, because you're never going to have more power than the boss.
Yeah, that's right.
But in some ways, Tony Giacalone had more power than the boss.
Wow.
And Tony Giacalone was one of the guys that the boss, Jack Tocco, I can tell you this, feared him. I don't say he feared for his life, but if Tony Giacalone wanted to do a hostile takeover of the family, he probably could have. He could have got everybody to back him. He could have killed Jack Tocco and named himself the boss, kind of like a John Gotti move. But he didn't, because he respected Jack. Also, Tony Giacalone's mentor, Uno Zarelli, named Jack Tocco the boss for a reason. Well, Tony Giacalone was Uno Zarelli's driver and like his protege. So he this looked up to him and like idolized him. So when his idol said, the next boss is going to be Jack Tocco, not even my son. Because instead of naming his son Tony Zarelli, he named Jack Tocco his nephew. So Tony Giacalone said, okay, that's who the boss wants to be the boss, and I respect that, and I'll take it to the grave. Now, Jack Tocco, when he became boss, named his cousin, Tony Zarelli, the underboss. And that kind of pissed off Tony Zarelli, because he always felt like he should have been the boss. His dad was the godfather. His dad passed him over and named his cousin the boss. So now this creates a rift in the family for years. And then for many, many years, they were just at odds with each other the whole life. So basically, Tony Zarelli had his own little mini mob within the Detroit Mafia, and Jack Tocco kind of let him have it. It was his cousin. They came up in the streets together. They made their bones together. They killed people together. So Tony Zarelli had this kind of crew of misfits, and Jack Tocco was the boss, had everything else. But Tony Giacalone was also kind of his own crew, too. He was the street boss. And a lot of Mafia families, like the first family to ever really have a declared street boss was Detroit. And Tony Giacalone was a street boss. His brother was just about equal to him, Billy Giacalone. And these guys ran everything. I mean, all the bookies, all the gambling, it all went through them. If you wanted to run a sports book in Detroit, you either had to have their blessing or they'd send me, someone like me, and said, you're going to pay up. You'll pay up or be killed. That's it. There's no choice. You have no choice. You're going to pay us a percentage of your book. We know who's betting with you, and you know what you're taking in on the book. You're going to give us 10% or 20% or whatever it is every week, or you will be killed. Yeah. That's your choice.
Yep.
Or stop betting. And so, anyways, that's how it worked. And then drugs. Tony Giacalone had a bunch of black drug dealers. Blacks, he kind of pruned these blacks in the ghetto and prepared them and raised them and groomed them to be like he taught them how to structure their organizations like a mafia family. So you had Frank Usher and literally the black mafia. And you had this other guy named Fiotis, and he had a handful of these black drug dealers. And they would provide them with drugs. They had tons of heroin coming in from Sicily and Turkey and whatever. And they'd bring it in barrels of pasta sauce, going to these restaurants. And then, so they had the drugs. They had everything, man. And then, of course, the municipal contracts. But most of those municipal contracts it was basically Jack Tocco would issue them to whoever, you know, would kick the most money up. So these big multi-million dollar contracts to you, and one 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 to you. He just waves the wand. You get one, you get one, you get one. We're talking $20 million contracts. Sanitation, wow. $40 million a year to remove garbage from whatever. One for you, one for you, one for you. And then everybody brings a nice fat envelope, you know, not to him directly, but they send somebody over. Like, you know, a perfect example would be my grandpa. They would bring the money to my grandpa, because my grandpa was his cousin, and he would come over all the time and hang out. So maybe some like Tony Corrado or somebody would bring over $100,000 in cash, and then he'd pull up in the driveway, and then Jack Tocco would come over, and then when he got to the house, here's $100,000 in cash, and he'd, you know, stuff it down his pants and walk back to his car, and he'd have his cash. Then he'd give that cash to somebody else to put in a private bank, or he had bankers bought off money all over the place. To give you an idea of the magnitude of Jack Tocco's wealth, when he died, the FBI said he owned over 100 legitimate businesses all over the country. And they estimated his net worth at about $100 million.
Whoa. Now,
I'm going to go, that's a low figure. And so Scott Bernstein, who's my friend, Scott Bernstein is a true crime writer. He wrote the book Motor City Mafia about my family.
Okay.
He's actually a co-host on my show. And he's a brilliant, super smart guy. He writes about the mafia. He's written a bunch of books. He's written movies. He wrote the White Boy Rick movie. He just did the Netflix documentary.
He wrote White Boy Rick.
Super freaking.
We're only just talking about the.
Him the other night.
Yeah, that's right.
It's Seth's partner.
Wow. Okay. And so, Seth's been a guest on the Clink here. What a legend he is. Big shout out, Seth.
Yeah, yeah. Shout out Seth. That's my dog. That's a good dude, man. One legend. Of the best. They're going to make a movie out of his life, and that's going to be successful.
Oh, yeah.
His life is incredible, too. I love that guy. I was just in St. Louis with Seth a couple weeks ago. He flew me down to be in his new documentary. So
yeah, we did talk about that. We talked about that a few weeks ago on the Clink, and it's going to be one I look forward to seeing over here in Australia. You guys have got some really hardcore shit down over there.
We filmed for like an hour, so I'm hoping I get a few minutes of airplay in there, but he likes me. So anyways, the thing is, the amount of money that was pouring in, it's like I said, you get a lot of these like mob groupies on YouTube, and they're all from New York, and they think that everything that's not New York is just nothing. They're like, oh, Detroit's just a little crew of like nobody, because they don't know. There's not a lot of information on Detroit mob out there. And the reason why there's not a lot of information out there, no rats. You don't have guys on YouTube parading around telling. Nobody's ratting. Even me, I don't, everything that I've talked about, I talk about my own stories from my life or people that are dead. I don't talk about nobody current, you know, I don't know nothing. And so I tell stories from my life, my past, my experience, or dead people.
And that's exactly what we do on the Clink. That's exactly how it is on the Clink.
Yeah.
And look, and be honest with you.
Right.
Brother, I've been around the same, not the mafia, but the underworld here in Australia. We run a podcast here, but we're not what we call dogs or rats, you know. We don't sit here talking about other people's business that's, going to incriminate or anything like that. And
right. Exactly.
That's I'm very proud that we're able to deliver that, and that's why we have the guests on that we do, like yourself.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, my only point of saying that is the reason why there's so much knowledge or information about the New York mafia families is because they've had over 500 guys cooperate in the last 20 years. Where you go to Detroit, you've had one guy.
One.
He ain't talking on YouTube. He only one. And he ain't on YouTube talking about it either. He's in witness protection, hiding, and that's that. And the thing is, so there's not a lot of information. And like, again, and a lot of you is like, oh, Detroit's small. It only got 50 made guys or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. It's only got 50 made guys. And each one of them are making millions of dollars, opposed to the 300 made guys that you guys got in a Bonanno family. And they're all making nothing. The peanuts, because there's a bunch, there's the street guys and it's hanging out in pool halls. These guys that I'm talking about are making freaking $3 million a year off their legitimate business, and their legitimate business comes from the boss who gives them the contract for that, and he gives them a kickback, and they control strip clubs, nightclubs, every kind of food distribution, everything. They got a hand in all the unions. And so what I'm saying is you might only have 40 or 50 made guys at the most, right? And then each, but here's what they don't get. So you got, let's say you got 40 made guys. Each one of those guys probably have 10 guys in their crew. And those guys are guys like me who are earners, and most of them are cousins, nephews. So they're either cousin, or they're guys like me. And so they got each, those 30, 40 guys, each got 10 guys like me. And like I said, they're almost all blood related. That's another thing that makes them very different from other families. And then I got myself probably 6 or 8 guys that I work with all the time who are scumbags, drug dealers, robbers, you know, shakedown guys, thieves, box men, whatever they are. These are guys that work with me all the time, and they're my own little crew, and they know I'm working for my Uncle Pete, you know what I'm saying, who's got his crew of 10 guys, and he's working under Tony Jack, who's got his crew of, like, you know, 30 guys. So it goes up, and at the end of the day, you might have 500 or 600, you know, wise guys or mob guys, connected mob guys, and it's not a small family. It's not peanuts. And the difference is these guys are making real legit money. Yeah. You can look them up and look at their mansions and crap, man. These guys got mansions. They got vacation homes in Miami, vacation homes in Sicily. They're not your average, like, you know, low-level street dudes. There are street guys like me, low-level street guys, who don't have mansions and stuff. But I'm talking about the guys, you know, you see, when you do hear a little about some of these guys, and you're not hearing about it through informers, you're hearing about it from true crime journalists like Scott Bernstein's, the guys who do the research, they read the FBI transcripts, they listen to the wiretaps, all this stuff that's legal, and then they say this guy's that guy here. So they write an article about him or something.
Right.
And here's this guy. But he's a guy who's got a $4 million house in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and he owns 3 freaking businesses that are legitimate, and he's making all this money, but he's got tons of money pouring in. And I guess that makes it different from other, you know, mafia families. So it is quiet, super quiet, super small, super secretive. And I will say this, it's super, like, growing up the way I grew up, I was taught by my Uncle Pete that you just don't share any business, anything, with outside of the guys you're working with. He says, so if I assign you to a crew, these 3 guys, right, and you're going to rob this dope dealer, you're gonna work your way up into the graces of this dope dealer, and then you get him to 100 pounds of weed, then you're gonna rob him and tell him, you know, I'm keeping it, I'm not paying you, F you, what are you gonna do, I'll freaking kill you. He's like, so you're gonna do this. Now if I do that with these 3 guys, and it might take a month or something, 2 months to work up to it, because we're buying the weed, when I finally do punch the guy in the mouth, put a pistol in his mouth, listen, I'm taking the weed, I'm blowing your head off, if you see anything about it, I'm gonna freaking blow your head off, you know, whatever. I mean, it's pretty simple. You punch a guy in the mouth, knock his teeth out, put a pistol into his forehead and say, listen, it's game over. I'm taking the weed. You're not going to come kill me. If you do, I'll kill your whole family. You got that? If you think you're going to come after me, our guys will kill your whole freaking family. And they're like, yeah, no, it's good. Take it. I'm like, yeah, because you want to breathe a freaking another minute of your life. Safe.
Yep.
So anyways, I don't go around talking about that with anybody. Nobody but my uncle and those 3 guys. So nobody outside of that little crew will ever know that's what happened. Rumor might happen, like it might get to someone else, but not me. That's how it works with every single time you do a score or a racket, or you're involved in anything. And it, like I said, it kind of deferring to, like, New York is so open. They want everybody to know they're with this
business
guy. Oh, I'm with Tommy. Everybody, I'm with Tommy. I'm with him. He's a made guy. I'm with them. And like, if you do that in Detroit, You'll be killed. I've seen it happen.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow any stunt for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record. 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 For the record,